Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Okay, ready. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and this whole hour we have been talking about... Go ahead.
Guts.
Guts.
In the last section, we talked about bacteria and the armies of them that are in your gut.
Yeah, the problem is that they're a little hard to picture. They're kind of abstract.
Why don't we finish with a story that makes the whole issue real and much more concrete? This is the tale of a troubled relationship between a man...
and his on-again, off-again gut.
Yeah.
Hello.
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 Man's name is John Reiner. He's a writer, lives here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So one day you are eating your way through your life as you usually do, and then things take an odd turn.
Yeah, how did it begin?
It began with a surprise. I was at home, and I was about to go make myself a tuna fish sandwich.
But John thought, you know what, let me go to the bathroom first, get that out of the way. So he sits down on the pot to do his business.
And I felt a funny twinge in my gut.
Now, John has had gut pain before.
I suffer from something called Crohn's disease, which is a gastrointestinal condition. But I had gone through a period of about a year's remission, excellent health.
And so when this pain came on, John figured, no big deal.
It seemed to come out of nowhere, and I thought, it'll go away out of nowhere.
Like usual.
But it didn't. Within about, you know, a minute, what was a small twinge all of a sudden felt like a knife into my gut.
Before long?
I'm on my living room floor, flat on my back, and I can't move.
John calls an ambulance, they rush him to the hospital, and when they get there, the doctors take one look and tell him, your intestines were clogged, and now they've burst.
And it's now spreading bacteria throughout your system. Basically, you're on the verge of having sepsis.
Meaning, you could die.
So you need emergency surgery. But
they also told him
that I should recover.
And when he came out of the OR, it looked like he would. But the doctor said, let's play it safe. Stay here for a week. We'll feed you through an IV and give your gut a break.
So I'm on an IV for a couple of days. And I've been on nothing by mouth in the hospital numerous times before, but always for 4 to 5 days.
And after 4 or 5 days, John says, what normally happens is that you'll start to feel hungry again.
And that's a great sign. That means that your gut is healing and...
it's ready for food. But this time, that didn't happen. In fact, he says he got sicker.
Nausea, vomiting, chills, fever spike.
So the doctors take more pictures of John's insides, and they notice something weird.
In the area where I had the tear in my intestine, there's now a fistula, which is a hole.
Now, normally this is something you could sew right back up. But the doctors tell him, in your case...
no. The tissue around the area of the tear is so compromised that you can't withstand another surgery right now. Plus, you've got high level of infection again. You're no candidate for surgery.
Our only solution, they tell him, is to let your gut heal on its own. But in order to do that, we've got to shut it down.
Yes.
Basically numb it with anesthesia.
So my gut was in an induced coma. Nothing would pass through it. There would be no activity.
Which meant, the doctors told him, obviously, no eating. Instead...
we're going to put you on a food pump. And the food pump is a mechanical pump about the size of, and the weight of 2 bricks.
Huh.
Carry it in a backpack.
And the pump in the backpack is attached to this big bag.
Big bladder, the big 3,000 milliliter bag of TPN is the medical name for the nutrients.
What does that stand for?
Total parenteral nutrition. And wow. The stream runs, you know, out of the pump through the tube into my arm.
You were going to be given essentially an outdoor stomach.
That's right.
And this is where our story really begins. So John goes home with his new exostomach. He can't eat, but every day around mealtime, he says, he would turn on the food pump. And this is actually what it sounds like.
So I'd start my feeding at 4 o'clock. pump would start. I'd sit on the love seat for a while. My kids would come home from school. My wife would come home from teaching. And then the real food would come into the apartment.
Sometimes neighbors brought food over. Sometimes John's wife would cook. But regardless,
I was always sitting on the love seat in our living room with the food pump whirring.
Like a dishwasher.
Mm-hmm.
While just a few feet away, his family would sit at the table.
Eating fabulous food.
Night after night, this happens.
And it's making me absolutely crazy.
And he says, after about a week of this, and then 2 weeks, and then 3 weeks of just sitting there, night after night, watching his family eat dinner without him, he says he would start to drift off and get lost in these really vivid daydreams of meals that he'd eaten in the past.
One of the first memories I have is going to Katz's for the first time.
Eggs over here, ladies and gentlemen, please.
Katz's is a famous Jewish deli in Manhattan.
Robert, how you doing?
And standing there at the counter,
pastrami, I'm right with mustard, right?
Where the counterman cuts the pastrami and he puts it on a plate and it, you know, he gets it out of the hot cooker and it's on a fork and he hands it to you and you take a taste.
And he says in that particular instance, when he took a bite, that first bite of the pastrami sandwich, it was like pow. He says it was the first time in his life where he was like, oh my God, I'm Jewish. I am Jewish.
These are my people.
And that was the first time you felt that?
It was.
And after about a month of no food at all, and these vivid daydreams about food, something weird happened. John got hungry, like actually hungry, which really doesn't make much sense because hunger signals normally travel from the gut up to the brain, and his gut was numb. But he says he really started to feel hungry.
It was, you know, I think of it, it was an existential hunger.
And it got really bad. For example.
My wife's a terrific cook. And one night she made a little treat for the kids, mini burgers and french fries. And our small apartment smelled like the kitchen of a White Castle.
Yeah.
So my wife brought out this big plate of sliders and a pyramid, and the kids were knocking down the pyramid and throwing them back. And I couldn't take it anymore. So I snuck out of the living room while they were preoccupied. I went into our kitchen, and there were some fries on the stovetop. And I put my hand on the fries, and I brought them up to my mouth. And I was expecting salt and oil.
Fatty goodness.
Like fatty goodness and the texture of crunchiness and all that.
I'm tasting it now.
And I put it on my tongue, and I got nothing.
Nothing?
Really?
And I'm rolling it around.
Absent, you can't even feel it on your
tongue?
I mean,
my tongue feels...
Not even the salt?
It's like when you go to the dentist and you've got Novocaine. And,
really?
And my tongue is numb.
What
and I'm rolling. So
on?
I start.
Was it your tongue just out of practice?
I couldn't figure out what was going on. And then I brought up a knife.
And John claims that when he looked at the reflection of his tongue in this metal knife,
I see that my tongue is as flat and smooth as this Formica tabletop I've got my hand on in your studio.
Oh, so they don't have the little bristly furry
things? No bristles, right. And I realize I haven't used it in so long that my taste buds have evaporated. You know, they're gone. And at the moment that that happens, my oldest son, Teddy, who was 9 at the time, comes in and he says, Dad, you're not supposed to eat. I said to him, I wasn't eating.
It's like you switch places almost.
And he looked at me with the most scornful, disgusted, just ashamed expression, and I was completely humiliated. I'd not only failed
you
as an eater.
Shame flood.
Right. I'd failed as a father as well.
As the weeks dragged on and John didn't get any better, he actually started to take that thought seriously. Like maybe he really was failing at being a dad.
I'm a stay-at-home dad. And as a result, I'm the shopper and the cooker and the food planner and the provider for us. And I was out of commission, 3 years out of work.
With no gut. Meanwhile,
I can't stop thinking about food. I'm remembering food that I ate 20 years ago, like I had that afternoon. And I'm online looking up menus from restaurants that I've gone to.
Really?
Yeah. And looking up recipes, you know, for dishes that I've made.
And this obsession grew and grew until one night, he says, his neighbor, Marcia,
decided to cook for us one night when I wasn't eating. and she brought down a chocolate bundt cake for my wife and kids to eat.
Walks it right past John on the way to the kitchen.
And I could smell this thing. I could smell the rum. I could smell the eggs. I could smell the flour. I could smell everything.
So again, he sneaks into the kitchen.
And I lower my nose down to this bundt cake, and I'm smelling it, and I'm sniffing it, and I'm inhaling this thing like an anteater. And that's not enough in my state. So I plunge my hands into the chocolate cake.
You what?
I plunge my hands into the chocolate cake.
In order to get one with the goo or what?
In order to get some sensation of connection with food.
Did you think, what's happening to me? Or did you think, oh,
the joy?
At
the moment my fingers were in this cake, I felt I'm in heaven. I've reconnected with the living. I have food, if not in me, at least on me. And at the moment where I'm experiencing most pleasure, my wife comes into the kitchen.
When I went in to get the kids some more food, I found him.
This, of course, is John's wife, Susan.
With his hands in the cake, just trying to touch the crumbs. And he looked so guilty. And I was also like, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
Like somebody going through an underwear drawer. It was very, you know, wrong.
And I have no explanation. I mean, I can say, I need to do this. You have no idea how wonderful this is. Please give me some time alone with my bundt cake. You know.
It was just, it was this bizarrely funny but deeply sad, perverse moment.
Yeah.
I suppose it was the first crack in my bubbled attempt to pretend things were normal. You know, I realized how bad things had gotten.
And after that, she says, things only got worse.
It just became, there was never anything to be happy about. He wasn't able to eat. He wasn't sure what the prognosis was. He wasn't sure if he was going to need a second surgery. It was just all bad.
She says John became really depressed.
And he became very difficult to even, not even to cheer up, but just to say, well, let's just not talk about it for now. You know, he was constantly expressing his unhappiness.
Was that the thing? It was just dark all the time?
Very dark. It just became very hard to face.
So, she left.
Well, I had spring break, and my kids had spring break.
So Susan took the kids to her parents' place in Indiana for a week.
I needed to take a break.
Not for good. Maybe the kind of break that means, I'm not really sure what our future looks like.
I don't know how we're going to do this.
And I can't really figure that out while I'm with you.
So I was alone.
Not entirely.
While I was on the food pump and not doing well.
But after a few days of moping around the house, John gets an idea.
What I need to get myself out of this is I need to return to a place of sanctuary for me. There was a restaurant not far from your studio here called Chanterelle. It's a French restaurant. And it was one of these very expensive capital letter restaurants that my wife and I had always planned to go to if we had a special occasion. For years, I walked past this restaurant and I would look in the window before getting onto the subway. And I would see the plates of, you know, scallops coming out and the wine steward pouring, you know, red wine and the handwritten menus on the tables and things like that. So I thought, if I can get to Chanterelle and if I can look through the window, then I can heal myself. I'll have a reason to hope. So I got on the subway, and it was past 4 o'clock, and I was supposed to be home starting up the pump and feeding. And I got off the subway, and I walked over to Chanterelle, and I was kind of a little dizzy and delirious. And I get to the window, and the dining room is empty. There's dust on the floor. The wall panels have been stripped. The tables are bare. It's empty. It's a cave. Sometime in the intervening months, or the preceding months, rather, Chanterelle has closed. Oh, and man. I didn't know that.
Oh, you're killing me with this story.
And I think to myself, you've reached the end of the line. This is it. There's nowhere else to go. And I walk towards the river. And I know that people throw themselves in when they do this. And it never made sense to me before, you know. I wasn't ever ready to end things.
Were you really?
Because I was.
Were you having suicidal thoughts? I mean,
I was having really depressed thoughts, and I don't know that I would have thrown myself in, but it was the first time I was standing at the edge, thinking about it, thinking about this is how these things happen. So I got to the river, and I blacked out, collapsed on the sidewalk, and I woke up and it was dark. I'd scraped my chin and my elbows were bruised and I'd taken a hard fall. And I got up and I started to walk around. I was on this buckled old sidewalk and I looked around and there are these federal era houses. And there was a grill, a gas grill in one of the backyards that was going. Somebody was cooking dinner. And I could smell it. I could smell the smoke coming off the grill. And I could smell it. It was pork chops. Mm-hmm. And I was so delirious and so happy to be smelling food that I took it upon myself to finish cooking this guy's meal. So
wait, what?
So I...
That's so eerie.
I lifted up the lid and it looked like to me, you know, one side of the pork chops were cooked and they were ready to be flipped. So I flipped them. And I was so far gone that I thought, okay, well, 4 more minutes and these babies are going to be ready to go. And I didn't have a watch, so I started counting down 4 minutes in my head because I was going to get this stuff perfect. And all of a sudden, the back door of this townhouse opens up and a guy walks out with an apron on and a cocktail in one hand and a seasoned shaker in the other. And he looks at me and... I look very borderline. I mean, I'm rail thin. I've got, you know, I'm cut up from having fallen on the sidewalk. I've got, you know, a crazy expression in my eyes. I haven't shaved in, you know, a week. I look really very unsavory. So he sees me, and I have no way of explaining myself other than to say, they're just about done. And I hand him the tools. And I turn around and I walk away before he has the chance to call the police or anything like that.
How many years ago was this?
This was now 3 years ago.
And what do you take away from that? Was that some kind of turning point where you walk away from the grill and you're ready to fight the good fight or what?
That only happens in the movies and in fairy tales. What actually happened was I got sick again. I had another infection, more bacteria. And I had to go back to the hospital. And when I went back to the hospital this time, they said, okay, we can't even do the food pump anymore because you keep getting these infections. And if the bacteria spreads to your bloodstream through the food pump, then you'll be gone. And we can't operate on you because you won't survive the surgery. So all we have left is to try eating. The only thing that's left is to go back to food. Because you can't ingest it intravenously. We're afraid of infection. And we can't repair your gut surgically. So the only way you can keep yourself alive is to try to use your gut again.
So
they start you on a round of, baby food, Gerber's?
I did start on the traditional applesauce and Jell-O and pudding, soft and easily digested foods.
And John says it worked. His body was able to take the food.
But I couldn't taste anything. And it continued that way for another couple of months.
And did the food ever taste like food again?
Well, I was at the radiologist.
This is not the scene I was expecting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a little ritual with this particular radiologist. He's on the east side. And whenever I get tests there, when I'm done with the tests, I'm able to eat again. And again, this is when you do test prep, you're going about 24 hours without eating. So, you know, the thought of food becomes a celebration that you're going to have, right? So there's a diner on 3rd Avenue and 84th Street, 85th Street that I always go to. And I get the same meal every time. I sit at the counter and I get a fried egg and bacon sandwich on whole wheat toast. So I went there and I got the last seat at the counter and I ordered my usual. And I chew into it and I realize that I've got sort of embryonic flavors going on. I've got the sort of the start of the sensation of tasting and the start of flavors in my mouth. And I could feel that great combination of the fried egg congealing with the crunchy bacon and the crunchy toast. And I do the same you know, I've got a knife, a butter knife, and I do the same mirror knife examination at the counter. And I can see that where before it was shiny and smooth as a porpoise, I've got little bristles. I've got little bumps on my tongue, and I can taste this fantastic $3 sandwich.
Do you kiss the lady sitting next to you?
Well, I turn to the guy sitting next to me, and I tell him, this is the best damn thing I've ever eaten. And in classic New York diner fashion, he looks at me. He looks up from his Kindle. He looks at me, and he says, you should try the meatloaf. And I think, you know, this is it. I'm back, baby. I'm back.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate, too. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste the bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dish.
Thanks, of course, to John Reiner, whose book is called The Man,
The Man Who Couldn't Eat.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
Pass me a pancake, Mandrake. Having a derby, Irby. Look in the Fendel, Mendel. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Start of message.
This is John Reiner. Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad. Jad Abumrad. Our staff includes Ellen Horn, Soren Wheeler, Pat Walters, Tim Howard, Brenna Farrell, Dylan Keefe, Lynn Levy, and Sean Cole, with help from Matt Keelty, Rachel James, Brendan McMullen, and Rafaela Benin.
Special thanks.
Special thanks.
Special thanks.
To Christian Lutzer,
Clint Berger,
Barry Jesse,
Carl Bagnell,
and
the Rutgers University Animal Care Program.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Bye.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
End of message.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.